Hey, good morning, Lewis.
Good morning, Lucas. Let's see if did you send an invite to a will?
I did.
Okay.
So, but yeah, while we wait for him, we can go ahead and get started. Welcome everybody to another episode of the Lewis and Lucas podcast. I'm half your podcast, Lucas. With me, as always, is Lewis. How are you today,
I'm
sir?
doing great, man. I'm doing great.
Good.
Just bright and early here, and not as early as you. I hear you're
No.
much earlier than me. Yeah,
Yeah, I don't know if you can hear the hotel music or the escalator in the background, but I'm coming to you live from Resort World in Las Vegas.
nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, every time I hear about Las Vegas, I always think of the movie Lost in America, where he gets kind of retires early. He's like 50 years old, and his wife, he gets a bad job transfer or whatever, and he says, "You know what? Let's just quit and retire. We'll travel the country." So they got an RV. They had this little nest egg of money, and then they first stop, they decide to swing by Vegas and kind of have a renew their marriage vows and that kind of stuff. And he wakes up in the morning, his wife's not in the bed, and he goes down and she's gambling the whole night, and she gambled away their entire nest egg
Oh no.
their first night of the journey for them. So
Oh my
it's a funny movie,
gosh.
but
Yeah, I don't know. I've never really gotten into gambling. I know, like, so the reason we're out here is my boss lives out here. He throws a holiday party every year, so we're out this weekend to do that. But yeah, my boss likes to gamble. There are people on my team that like to gamble. I've never really understood, like, they sit around the craps table and shooting dice, and like I've never felt the desire that I guess other people feel to throw money down to see, to see what happens.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
don't know. It's not appealing
I'll
to
tell
me.
you what, I'm way more risk averse of money. So like the idea of like giving away my hard-earned money, even if it was I thought I had a chance to win. I mean, the idea of losing it hurts me more than the idea of winning it, I guess.
Exactly, because then you win. If you win, then you're like, well, I mean, I just got lucky. Like, I'm probably going to lose it next time for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
So the food is amazing out here. The live music, that those are my favorite aspects of Vegas. That's what my wife and I always do, hit the spa, eat. Like last night we had really good. I've never been to a Spanish restaurant. And I didn't know that chilled soup was a thing. I was like, oh, this is incredible.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, like what kind of chilled soup? Like gazpacho?
I think it was something
Yeah,
like that.
gazpacho. I grew up eating
Yeah.
gazpacho. It's good.
Oh,
Yeah, so
okay. Nice. See, you're a more cultured man than I am.
maybe. Yeah, that's probably true.
Well, hey, while we're waiting for our special guest, we can go ahead and get into the topic if you want.
Yeah, that's cool. Will hopefully will join us. Will from Renaissance of Men. He's a really good guy. Hopefully he didn't get the time wrong or anything. It's possible, but I guess we'll see. So hopefully this has not been false advertising for everybody. If not, we'll have him on at some point in time in the future. But hope,
Well, and we could
yeah.
talk about this too, because I think what's interesting is whenever you bring up masculinity, it's met with derision. People like, oh, why, who cares about masculinity? And it's more bad than there's more negative connotations associated with masculinity than positive. But I would not expect, so I expect to have that conversation when talking to just regular, Twitter people. But I would not expect to have that same conversation with Christian Twitter. That's been really eye-opening watching Will post different things that seem biblical, and he points out like the Apostle Paul calls us to be manly, and the Theo Bros, as they call them, will hop in and be like, "Well, actually," and it's like,
Yeah, by the way,
it's
he
so
just messaged
annoying.
me. He did have the time wrong, so he looks like he's joining us now. So
I see him.
Hey guys.
Hey, Will.
Hey,
sorry about that.
Doing?
I thought
I
thought the call was at 7:30 for some reason.
No problem at all. It's probably who knows where the miscommunication came from, but no issue. How you doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you guys?
Good, man. You're surviving okay with the early wake up here on Saturday. Sorry about this. We're just we like to rock and roll early on the weekend here.
Yeah, I'm doing okay. It's just been some late nights lately, which has been tough, but that's okay.
Is that late nights hanging out with the boys or late night with the kiddos? I don't know. Do you have kids?
I don't have kids. No.
Okay, so no. With the boys,
late nights. neither late nights working.
Oh,
but
okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Lewis and I were just talking about how it's funny, you know, Christian masculinity. I noted that, you know, people associate masculinity with negativity, whatever. But you would expect in Christian circles that that wouldn't be the case. And yet, as anybody who follows you knows, people, Christian Twitter people will come at you with like, oh, actually, I mean, you'll post things that are biblical, reasonable about masculinity. People are always like, whoa, I don't know. It's like, oh, it's got to be super annoying.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out why that's the case. Because for me, you know, I came to Christ through studying men and masculinity for 20 years. And when I finally arrived, I was the most surprised person that was the ultimate destination from given everything that I've explored and everything that I've done. But I didn't find any contradiction between masculinity and Christianity at all in what I had been studying. And in fact, it completed everything that I had been studying. And so it's been a bit of a surprise to me to start talking about this stuff and to see, like, I understand if men in America and around the world have been feminized or not properly fathered, you know, or had absent, abusive, or distant fathers. Like, that's a worldwide phenomenon, especially a Western phenomenon for the past 50 years. Like, I get that, but the active resistance, like and then like throwing scripture verses and like in defense of why it's okay to be the way this way, like, that's the part that doesn't make sense to me. It's like, if I show you a better, more fulfilling way to be a man, not with any sense of accusing or criticizing your inherent worth as a human being, but saying there are things that you weren't given or things that were actively taken from you in childhood, you can have a more fulfilling life now and be and lead your family better if you just absorb, embody these sets of principles that are our inheritance as men. To find that, you know, people will just throw up scripture verses in response. I don't know about that. It's like, that doesn't make any sense to me. And that, I mean, it's part of being Christian just in general, I guess, in some reform circles, that everything has to be accessed through a theological lens first. That doesn't make sense to me either, but I think slowly the embodiment of virtue wins men over. It's just going to take more time than I thought.
So, hey, sure. let's level set real quick. So, Will, why don't you introduce yourself real quick and like what your effort is, what your organization is, what your website does, what you do personally, and how that ties into masculinity, how that ties into Christianity. Kind of who are you and what do you do? Give us an overview there.
Okay, so where to begin? So I host a podcast called The Renaissance of Men, and when I started this about 2.5 years ago, I was originally planning to be a psychotherapist. I've been blessed to travel the world, 33 countries on 6 continents. And got to experience, you know, all these different ways of being, many different religions, you know, and spiritual practices as well before I came to Christ. So I had all this information. And then when COVID hit and the world got shut down, I realized, well, why would I go to school for 3 to 5 years to be a therapist in an office in Phoenix, which who knows if that's ever going to happen again. That's, you know, 2020, when I could share some of what I have to offer to men around the world now. And I had a therapist who I'd seen for many years. He's like, well, I think you're fine to, you know, to start talking to clients as long as I'm careful about what it is I tell men that I can do. Like, obviously I'm not going to treat clinical depression or anxiety, certain forms of trauma and abuse are outside of my ability. But I think I realized that I think what most men need isn't actually therapy. They need masculinity, which is to say they need a feeling of efficacy in the world. They need the feeling of like, when I say I'm going to do something, I do it and I produce results in my life and I see the prosperity that's, you know, built into my bones to create. And when I do that, men respond to me differently. Women respond to me differently. My kids respond to me differently. And that's, I think, what a lot of men are missing. It's a symptom of the father hunger. So I was originally just going to be kind of a coach. And that is what I do now. But as I continued working through creating my podcast and my coaching and mentorship services, I found Christ and I discovered that the problems that I had identified were so much bigger than I realized. In fact, it continues to keep getting bigger and bigger. And as COVID progressed and as we got into 2020 and 2021, this conversation that had really been happening for around masculinity for 40 years, and we can talk about that separately, really started to peak, not just into mainstream culture, but it's also starting to happen in Christian culture as well. And so where I find myself today is kind of standing at the middle of three different streams. So you have the global conversation about masculinity, which is starting to become part of mainstream consciousness. You have the Christian conversation about masculinity, which is just starting to dawn as well as this rise of, I guess what we might call new age, you know, progressive religious, spiritual values, the divine feminine, and all of that as well. So I'm sort of sitting at the intersection of those three different trends. I suppose you could also say, you know, the homogenization of global culture, also known as global homo, that I've been blessed to see so many different cultures around the world and spend time with them. I can actually speak to how the world is, not how we're told it is, particularly in America. So that's kind of where I sit and the themes that I tend to discuss and how it applies to men's lives and how they can improve their lives in measurable, meaningful, and even godly ways and not a long period of time. So my podcast is conversations about those topics, and then my mentorship, I make that real in men's lives, and I host men's groups as well.
Nice. That's interesting. And it's such a relevant topic right now. I mean, obviously the 600-pound gorilla in this space is Mr. Andrew Tate and all his work that he's doing. He's obviously in the news recently for being arrested and got a giant following. And probably because of the overlap between conservatism and men as a whole, you know, for whatever reason, he's big in conservative circles as well. So maybe when we use this word masculinity, we're talking about, you know, we're talking about something, but maybe we could define that a little bit. So when Andrew Tate talks about masculinity, what's he talking about? When you talk about masculinity, not that you're an expert on Andrew Tate, but like, what does it look like to be masculine versus kind of that popular idea of machismo and masculinity?
That's a really great question. And I'm very glad you asked because, you know, Ryan Mickler is another one of the major leaders in the space. And he has a distinction between masculinity and manliness. I've liked that distinction, but I have my own version of it. So we'll start with his. Masculinity is amoral. It's not immoral. It's not moral. It's amoral. It's a tool, right? It's a set of qualities that you can apply to handle situations. So for example, strength, confidence, you know, what you said, machismo, stuff like that, you know, strength and confidence and boldness and outspokenness. These things can be used, for example, in defense of the truth and in defense of the gospel, in defense of your family, in defense of values, or it can be used in defense of self-serving ends, you know, in the pursuit of self-serving ends. It's amoral. It's however you choose to use it. So Ryan Mickler takes that and he says, masculinity is not equivalent to manliness. Manliness is to apply those masculine values towards righteous ends. So to be manly is not to be bold and brash and rude to people, you know what I mean? Because you're just the king of the universe. You know, it's to be confident and outspoken in service of I guess you might say, your family and the people who are important to you in a way that respects others, right? So that's being manly. And so I like that distinction, but I don't know that I like the language. So what I've been talking about lately is virtue. Masculinity is amoral, but masculinity in the pursuit of virtuous masculinity, I think is the true goal that men really aspire to. So they look at Andrew Tate, and certainly he has his own set of virtues, but I don't know that anyone would call him a virtuous man. You know, he's certainly wealthy and successful and popular and outspoken, and all these things are good. He's obviously a man of considerable gifts, but he's not a man of virtue. And I don't think that he would say that. I don't know that he could even make that case. And what I like about the use of the word virtue is that it has this quality of being unassailable. No one in their right mind will assail the concept of virtue. Perhaps they will. Perhaps Nietzsche might, you know, like, who's to say that a virtue is a real thing? But no one likes him and he's dumb. So I've been transitioning this year and will be continue to do so when I talk about masculinity, to talk about virtuous masculinity. And also virtue is this fascinating thing where a virtue doesn't live in isolation. A virtue must live in constellation. So you have the virtue of strength. Like, strength is great, but a man whose only virtue is strength is good for picking up heavy things, and that's about it. You know, so you make that man strong and wise, and you make him caring, and you make him learned. And as you stack up all these virtues, you begin to approximate the complete form of a man. Now, no single man can master all the different virtues. He puts them together in constellation in a way that serves him, and thus he constructs his own image of masculinity, but he is still a virtuous man. And I think that's what men aspire to become if they're properly discipled. I think it's what women are looking for, and I think it's what we're designed to be, certainly Christian men for sure. So my conversation this year will be around virtuous masculinity, and I think that draws a pretty sharp distinction between men who are just masculine and what we might call the true man.
Yeah, that's interesting, because as someone that has read a lot of ancient Roman sources and kind of pre-Christian sources, which you have to look out for when it comes to ethics and that kind of thing, because some of them, you know, obviously they're not coming from a Christian perspective, but they did have this ethic where a lot of the things that kind of get promoted as machismo, like going after women and, you know, flashy money, that kind of thing. The Romans viewed those as unmasculine, as feminine. So like, if you chased after women, if you were addicted to sex, that was a feminine thing. If you were, you know, flashy with your money, that was feminine. If you dressed flashy, that was feminine. Those were considered feminine values. So like the ancient Roman picture of a masculine man was a well-disciplined man, a man that's dressed in a understated way, maybe a guy that had some wrinkles on his face and a little bit older. You know, that was masculinity in the ancient Roman world. And it's interesting that we've kind of embraced their picture of femininity and said that's masculine in today's society, which is, I think, shows some of the confusion going on in society as a whole right now.
Absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. And it's real. It's a real sign of how far we've fallen. Okay, so the current phase of the dialogue that a lot of people know of, talking about masculinity, though not, it's not the only aspect of the dialogue right now, is called the manosphere. And what I say about the manosphere is that it tries to solve the problem of father hunger using a lot of older brothers. And Tate is the classic example of that, but he's not the only example, right? He's just, you know, his whole posture, as it is of many men who write about this right now, is like, I'm your cool older brother, or I'm your strong older brother. And that's great insofar as it goes. But one of the things that's so difficult about older brother, brother relationships, blood brother relationships, is that older brothers can tend to be competitive And so there's this aspect of this teaching relationship about masculinity that's at once, we might say, supportive, encouraging, even loving, and then it can switch to bullying very quickly. And so, so of course, there are many things to criticize about the men who talk about masculinity in this space. But one of the things that tends to show up is, you know, there are some truly broken guys out there, guys whose fathers, like, it's a huge tragedy. And I can talk for hours about this subject alone. There have been men that were absolutely abandoned by their fathers and absolutely brutalized emotionally by their mothers. Mothers who, in the words of my friend Allison Armstrong, sought to carve the man out of their sons when they were a boy. And this is a real, this is a very real phenomenon, very deep roots. And the response to many of these men who are generally identified as weaker men is, you know, to say things like, no one cares, work harder, to point the finger, to shame them, to scorn them, and essentially to be bullies. Now, some men, based on their relationship with their fathers, may respond to that. There is a truth to being a man, which is like a little bit, you are evaluated in some amount based on what you can produce. But this idea that no one cares, work harder, this shaming and this bullying is what shows up in that environment. It's absolutely terrible. And yet men throw money at it. It's like, yes, tell me more, criticize me more. And it's like, I don't know. Right. Yeah. And it's troubling. It's very, yeah, very troubling. Yeah. So I don't know.
Well, there is that element of men versus women. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the comedian Ryan Long, but he has a skit where he says motivational speakers for women. And the motivational speaker comes on and they're like, you are perfect the way you are. Don't change a thing. If anybody criticizes you, that's on them. And then the motivational speaker for men is like, you're a dirtbag. Get working harder. You're pathetic. If, you know, if you don't do 100 push-ups right now, nobody will love you or whatever. You know, like, yes, that's the distinction. And I think there is some truth to that, where like men tend to respond more to kind of that tough, I don't know if you call it older brother or whatever, but that tough message of, you know, suck it up and work harder. But I think you're right. That's an interesting distinction between the older brother and the father, because a father might tell you to suck it up, but he does it in a loving way that's not trying to break you, right?
Exactly.
And there's a big distinction there.
Yeah. Like when a father wants to motivate his son, his young son, maybe we're not talking about an adult, we're talking about, you know, a preteen or an adolescent or something like that. You know, there's a component of getting down on one knee, putting a hand on the shoulder, you know, maybe the kid's got some tears going and is really present with him emotionally and invites him out of whatever experience he's having and encourages him forward. And that's the role of a father. That's the role of a good father. Now, of course, there are many fathers out there who say, no one cares, work harder, suck it up, rub some dirt on it. Like that's a thing. But that's also complemented around the rest of the relationship, you know, hopefully the father would show up in a bit more loving way. But older brothers are almost never like that. I mean, unless there's a significant age difference, like 10 years or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But if it's like a 2 or 3 year age difference, that's where you get that dirtbag kind of thing. And okay, yeah, great. You know, it's a popular theme, but I think it's just a symptom of just how deep the father hunger runs, that any amount of pressure to move forward as a man, no matter if it's negative or positive, is received in a helpful way. And I think that's a symptom of the absence of masculinity from our society. And another symptom of that is that men look to books like Fight Club and American Psycho and the author Bronze Age Pervert, if you've heard of him, to talk about masculinity. Bret Easton Ellis and Chuck Palahniuk are homosexuals, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And yep. I'm pretty confident that Bronze Age Pervert is as well.
No, he is. That's I've heard that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And look, that's not a criticism of him, such as it is. Like I enjoyed many of the ideas in his book, but we've actually gotten to a pretty bad place. And frankly, Jack Donovan, who wrote the book The Way of Men, is also homosexual. Now, look, you know, I've met and spent time with Jack and all that. So none of these are personal criticisms. It's just to say that when men have to be taught about masculinity from homosexual men, that's not where that's supposed to be coming from. Right. That's right. So that's a symptom. That's not to say anything about their ideas either, because I think The Way of Men contains some very valuable ideas about four specific male virtues, which is strength, courage, mastery, and honor. These are four powerful virtues. Those are not the only virtues that men can embody, but those are important ones. And I think some of what Bronze Age Pervert has to say, by the way, Bronze Age Pervert, like that should be a sign there. I think some of what he has to say about the underworld, you know, being the source of empire's power, which I think is the main theme of his book, I think that's really important as well for men to understand that. But where men should be drawing their sources of masculinity from is from their fathers, is from their faith, is from Christ, is from the entire Bible. The Bible is full of masculine men, like with a capital M. Like Christ is the best example, the complete and the finished example of it. But as you look through the Bible, you see David, you see Solomon, you see Paul, you see Peter, Abraham, Moses, right? You see Adam in his original design. You see, and there are countless other examples. And why is it so hard to bring it back to Christianity? Why is it so hard for Christian men to look on literally any page of the entire Bible and see a model they should follow and instead decide to follow what they see in the Big Bang Theory? Right. It's like, yeah. I don't understand that. Like the gospel of the Big Bang Theory is masculinity.
Right. Right. Yeah. And tip to men out there, if the guy you're following has pervert in his name, you might want to rethink that.
Right. It tells you who he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Lucas, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, this rings true for me a lot. I have four kids, three boys. And one of the things that we talk about is fighting evil, and I'm glad I'm able to do this with my kids, and I wish my dad was around to do this with me. But one of my sons is struggling to not have bad dreams when he goes to sleep. You know, we prayed about, and then it occurred to me, because God, there's several verses in the Bible where God is the one who's controlling your dreams. And it's like, okay, well, in God's providence, you're having these dreams that are scary. And I said, son, like, why don't we pray instead that in these dreams, when you encounter evil, because I believe, you know, you're going to be a man one day, and that's what men do is fight evil. So let's pray before you go to sleep that when you have the scary dream, when the monster or the bad guy comes up, that you're able to fight them. You're able to kick the monster in the face and be brave and courageous. And he, you know, he gets a smile on his face. And his dreams got a lot better after that, which was really cool. But yeah, I love, like, there's, and you kind of alluded to this at the beginning about how you get a lot of pushback, unfortunately, from Christians. And is it because it's like, oh, we got to be meek and mild, and oh, you know, Jesus was, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth. Like, you know, what, I don't know what kind of roadblocks Christians are throwing at you and what you're trying to do. Will.
That's a great solution with your son as well. I think that's a wonderful way of comforting him as he confronts his dreams. And okay, so regarding what Christian men, the situation they're facing, you know, I think Michael Foster has a really good take on this in his book, It's Good to Be a Man. I look at it and I see it as a symptom of how far feminism has traveled, all throughout America, all throughout the West. I sometimes say that, you know, there are three added commandments. I think many Christians know the 11th commandment, thou shalt be nice. I think the 12th commandment is thou shalt not challenge the almighty woman. And the 13th commandment is thou shalt not judge. And I think what many men are sensing, not just in Christianity, but primarily in Christianity, is that ultimately we live in a feminist matrix where masculinity is defined as whatever men do that doesn't step on women's toes. And the notion of women leading, the notion of women being in charge in the house, in the whisper networks, in church, in the office, is this unchallenged matrix of authority that men live within. And it's a cult. And the way that you know it's a cult, the best definition for cult I've ever gotten, is that you get shamed when you leave. And when you leave the cult of feminism as a man and you start standing up for yourself by having backbone and spine and making the world make way for you in a righteous way, women are naturally, I think today, I think it's instinctive in many cases, they try to put that man back in his place. Because the overarching theme of the West right now is it's her turn. And that was Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan. And you can watch basically any Hollywood movie or any Netflix TV show, read any book, or look, turn on the news, and you'll see the terms of society being dictated by women. And I think that's traveled quite far in the Christian church. And I think in the quest to be nice and winsome and all these things, men intuitively have a sense that if they were to lead, women would have to follow. And a lot of women are not prepared to follow, despite what they may say. I think it's instinctive. I think feminism has convinced women. Again, some of this is only subconscious, but I think it's convinced women that if they don't have jobs and careers and lead and take the lead role, they are betraying generations of women before them who have been oppressed. They've bought the feminist theological lie that women have been oppressed through all of history. And so now every men must bow the knee to them. And when they encounter a man who will not bow the knee to a woman, women get very upset, and they exert social pressure on men through gossip, and which is shame, which is their form of force. And so I think men intuitively sense that, and that if they start standing up for themselves, they'll be subject to gossip and social shaming. And so that it's easier to stay safe within the matrix than it is to start disrupting the system. And I think tragically, my observation, now I know I'm the new guy around here, but my observation is that many pastors have absolutely failed in their discipleship as men and masculinity. And the few pastors I do know who have stood up on behalf of men are generally considered to be hated. And I've encountered this often in my work. In fact, I had a client, I still have a client who he told his wife that he was considering getting a mentor or a coach. And she went to my Instagram page and saw Doug Wilson and said, "You're not allowed to see any man who associates with Doug Wilson." And so I had to explain that guilt by association is unchristian, which it is, and that I should be evaluated based on my values, not because I had a Zoom call with somebody. And so thankfully, the man became my client, and he's taking a leadership role, and that takes a lot of boldness and for many men, and they don't feel supported by their pastors. They've been let down by their pastors. And so Christian men suffer a triple burden, which is they've in many cases been let down by their fathers. They've been let down by their culture, and they've been let down by their pastors. And so that's their disadvantage, which is heavier than the secular culture. But their advantage is as soon as their pastors begin standing up for them, and they reconcile with their father, which can mean just reconciling with who your father is, and they reconcile, and they decide that they're going to push back on culture, they'll be stronger than any man out there. But for right now, I think the inverse is that they end up quite a bit weaker than a lot of men.
I thought Lewis was going to go here, but
yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, there we go.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I feel like that theme within the church is a real theme. Kind of one of the OG masculine preachers that I'm not a fan of. He's kind of cheesy, but Mark Driscoll. I remember hearing Mark Driscoll 10 years ago say that within evangelicalism, the pastor is almost always kind of feminine. He talks soft. He wears, cardigan sweaters. He has this winsome, appeal. And I think part of that is that within the church, women tend to be the most active, right? They tend to be the fans of the pastor. They tend to be the ones cleaning up afterwards. They tend to, so there's this power source within the church that's very feminine. And I think a lot of pastors just respond to that. And I there's this element where they're like the guy's going into the pastorate, and it's not good, but they go into the pastorate and they're all kind of feminine, the guys going in there. And guys like Doug Wilson, who, by the way, I like, sticks out because he's not that way, right? And there's like this handful of pastors out there that are actually not that way. And they come across as these mean, boogeymen because they're not that sweet, winsome, nice, you know, guy. And like, that's, you know, I don't know how you fix that within the church, but I think the work like you're doing, and, you know, hopefully just the overall movement of the gospel will change that. But like, it's definitely in 2022, it remains a significant problem.
It's a huge problem. And there's a book called Muscular Christianity by Brett McKay from the website and podcast Art of Manliness. He's been at this for a long time. And Muscular Christianity was a movement within Christianity right around the First World War, Teddy Roosevelt, something like that, which was to apply manly virtues to Christianity and to celebrate those virtues within Christianity. And I think there's a book called Tom Brown's School Days at Oxford, I think, which was like one of those books. It's a fiction book, but that kind of embodied a lot of these values. And it was a very powerful movement. But in this book about Muscular Christianity by Brett McKay, which is available on Kindle, he talks about how all these values began shifting around the Industrial Revolution. So you had pastors, so the men were all going off to work in the factories, and the pastors were back in the village. So the pastors naturally became closer with the women because the pastors weren't in the factory. And so that was the beginning of that shift. Michael Foster traces it back to Bernard of Clairvaux with what he called bridal mysticism, this idea that if the church is the bride of Christ, then that means that we as individual men must be brides of Christ, which is not how that works. And so it has very, very very deep roots. And but I think what wasn't well acknowledged is like, okay, it's one thing for it to have deep roots. It's this idea that if you begin pushing back, you become a boogeyman. Like, I've listened to hours and hours of Doug Wilson and read many of his books and listened to him talk about his controversies, the things that he said about slavery, and listened to him talk about, you know, people criticize him, which doesn't make any sense to me, you know, having a repented and redeemed former pedophile in his church, which that seems to me to be the Christian thing to do, right? They level all these criticisms at him. And I've looked at Mark Driscoll as well. And, you know, I haven't investigated him super deeply, but like, the accusations are that he's this big bad man. It's like, well, is it that he was actually a bad man, or is it he actually was just a masculine man in a feminine environment? Like, I don't know. I'm not going to litigate that right now.
Yeah. But what gets me about Doug Wilson is like, if you just took his reputation, you would think that he's like an Andrew Tate kind of, like, you would think he's really edgy, controversial. You'd think kind of like this guy is,
or like the Fred Phelps, like
yeah, like Fred Phelps or something. That's his reputation. That's what you would think. And then you listen to him, or you read his blog. That's really good. The DougWills.com blog. And he's the most reasonable human being on the planet.
Like, yes,
he's very careful, very thoughtful, almost almost too much. Like, it's almost like, you know, like, he gets criticized from the right, where people are like, hey, quit including nuance, you know. So like, he, you know, he is not the reputation that he has. Like, it's crazy that somehow he got that reputation. But he's a very reasonable person when it's all said and done.
And that's what's so funny about it is I go to Apologia with Jeff Durbin and James White. So so that's, yeah, I mean, this is the first church, the first religious services that I've ever attended. I just became Christian in 2020, and I happen to live, and Mark Driscoll is here in Phoenix as well. So so I was about a year ago on New Year's, I was sick, I wasn't feeling well, I was staying with a friend, and so I was just like laying in bed watching Jeff Durbin and James White sermons, and then YouTube suggested Doug Wilson. I'm like, okay, I'll just watch some of these. And then I put together that Doug Wilson was connected with Michael Foster, who's a friend of mine. And then I started watching Doug Wilson. And so I've been watching him for about a year and like loving everything that he had to say. And so I'm always surprised. I mean, I get it all the time, like what his reputation is. I've had other Christians say you don't want to associate with him. And it's like, I have no experience of his reputation. I encountered him and his words directly. So it's always funny to hear that.
With Mark Driscoll, it's a little like... So back when, if you remember, Tim LaHaye was...
Yeah.
So when that scandal broke out, Mark Driscoll was one of a couple Christian leaders who said that, you know, maybe if his wife had been more wifely, then her husband wouldn't have succumbed to these homosexual temptations, whatever. So it's, yeah, with Mark Driscoll, I'm a little more, yeah, he has said some pretty we'll call them interesting things, whatever, but yeah, like that's really cool. You're at Apologia. I'm James White is probably my favorite teacher right now, even though I'm Presbyterian and they're, you know, they're Reformed Baptists.
Right.
But man, that's do you want to kind of quickly talk, because you said in the earlier you started on this studying masculinity and it led you to Christ. Do you want to try and take us through that journey, however quickly you want to do that?
Yeah, happy to. Happy to. So it's really interesting that I've been studying religion and spirituality for 30 years and then masculinity for 20 years, and I was probably the most surprised person that they ended up at the same destination. I'm kind of a bit overwhelmed by the truth of that. But just in thumbnail, you know, I grew up Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed. You know, all my grandparents were Jewish, and my first thoughts of really studying religion were when I was going in for my bar mitzvah. The rabbi, my Torah portion was the Ten Commandments, and this was like randomly assigned, which is like if you're going to get a Torah portion, you know, randomly assigned to you something out of the New Testament to read, or sorry, the Old Testament, you know, that's up there, you know, that's probably one of the ones you want to get. So I remember the rabbi saying, you know, the second five commandments are there so you don't violate the first five. And I was like 12 years old, and I was like, oh, isn't that interesting? And that was the first time that I ever had what I can identify as an active interest in, like, oh, this, I'm kind of curious to know more about this. Now, when I was a little kid, when I was like 8 years old, I read all the books in the library about Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and UFOs. Everyone else was reading like Hardy Boys and stuff like that, and I was reading about those books. So I guess I've always had, I guess, a spiritually oriented mind. And then I went to the Bay Area for college. And I started getting into a lot of the Eastern mysticism that kind of saturates that world. I studied Jungian psychology, and it was when I studied, I took a class on college and Carl Jung that I realized that my mind as a man is much deeper than pizza and beer and football. Like I thought, because I wasn't into those things, that there was something broken about me. And taking that class on Jungian psychology showed me that wasn't the case at all. So over the so and it was also during that class in Jungian psychology where I learned what the Lord of the Rings has to teach about men's minds, and that was very transformative for me to see the way that male psychology unfolds in the Lord of the Rings. And so that was when I got really interested in learning, like, wait a minute, if I'm not broken as a man. Like there's nothing broken about me, but I'm still experiencing a level of ineffectiveness in my life compared to these other men that I perceive as being more effective. How can I begin changing myself to be more in line with them while still being myself? And so that initiated my pursuit of, you know, learning more about men and masculinity over the next 13 or so years. Of course, I continued studying, you know, a lot of the Eastern mystical practices, you know, reading a lot of the books that are popular up in the Bay Area, like Be Here Now by Ram Dass, and a lot of Buddhist and some Hindu stuff. That was just kind of what I was steeped in. And then in 2013, I went on a men's retreat, a men's initiation retreat called the New Warrior Training Adventure. And that was when I discovered the power of initiation and the reality that, you know, behind the personas that we all adopt as men, that we're all carrying, all of us are carrying some pretty heavy burdens, and that we as men, that we rarely, if ever, share with each other, and that we as men have the capability of really healing each other and of really in finding strength together. And that was a major awakening for me when I discovered the men's movement. And then I got into men's groups after that, and again, continue deepening some of these practices, learning more about myself as a man, and seeing the way that we all reflect each other. And then doing those led me to end a relationship that I had just kind of trapped myself in for a while. And there's a lot to that, but It was something that I had gotten myself into and I needed to get myself out of. And I succeeded in doing that. And immediately at the end of the relationship, I went to the festival called Burning Man because I lived in the Bay Area. And that's just kind of, you know, what if you live in the Bay Area, you can just do that. Just hitch a ride out there and find someone to camp with versus making it this big thing. So while I was at Burning Man in 2015, I found my way into a Christian ministry group that had been leading Christian ministry at Burning Man secretly. They didn't advertise that they were Christian. They'd been there for 12 years. And they were the ones who first introduced me to Christ. But then after that, at that same festival, I also was introduced to somebody who helped me find an ayahuasca shaman in the Bay Area. Lewis, you and I can talk about that, but I'll keep the story moving. But I had always wanted to travel the world. And so I finally, coming out of that festival at the end of this relationship, had found the strength to do that. So I left to travel. I left the United States to travel in 2016. And that's when I went to places like India. And I did a lot of things that you do when you're in India. Go to a 10-day meditation retreat. Go to a giant Hindu festival, 190 million Hindus. I did more ayahuasca in South America. And I did New Age retreats at all the enclaves that basically you can go to. And so as I was going through all this, I was also doing these big time adventurous things like sailing the South Pacific, you know, climbing mountains at 17,000 feet, trekking over national parks, like doing these objectively hard things. So I was growing in my understanding of spirituality and growing in my understanding of masculinity, being forced into like legitimately dangerous situations where I have to show up and no one's coming to save you. Like not in a place where, like, I'm freezing to death overnight, not like that, where it's like, but you know, you're in the middle of this national park, like you don't feel well, like you got to get yourself out. Like there's no one coming for you. So stuff like that. And so when I returned to the United States in 2020, I was carrying all this information. And when I got back, my friends who at the ministry group in Burning Man sent me a book called Simply Christian by N.T. Wright. Now, I'd studied all these world religions and spiritual traditions, and I had found that all of them have a real big problem in that they don't actually know what to do with the existence of evil, for one. They don't know how to really process it. Eastern mysticism kind of denies it even exists, and a lot of New Age traditions kind of paper it over, and I had seen too much to know that that was true. And so I read the book Simply Christian, and in this book, N.T. Wright writes about how on the cross, this giant wave of evil came to crash over Christ, but he drove it back. His death and resurrection drove back this wave of evil forever. And I got it. I got it. Like it landed. And so I read Mere Christianity after that and Screwtape Letters. And I often say that it's the first time that anyone had talked to me about Christianity like I was an adult. And then I asked my friends to baptize me that following September in the Coeur d'Alene River when I went to visit them, my friends from Burning Man. And so since then, it's been a process of reconciling Christianity with masculinity, which I've used to successfully transform my own life. And I found there's no conflict. But to bring things around to the beginning, I was surprised to find that other men in Christianity see that there is a conflict. but I haven't found one. So that's how these two streams kind of flow together at this moment where it seems to be the conversation is up for everybody.
Yeah, that's super interesting. That book, by the way, Simply Christian, I don't know what you thought of it. I loved that book. I thought that was super good. And yeah. I'm obviously a giant C.S. Lewis fan also, so you got good taste in reading, or the people that recommended those books were good taste. So yeah, that's all stuff everybody should be checking out. And that's an awesome story. So you coming from a Jewish background, when you converted to Christianity, did it create stress within your family, or what was the response from your family side?
I lost my entire family.
Wow.
The only member of my family that still speaks to me, there's two, my dad. And I was a closet Christian for about 6 months after I got baptized, not knowing how to tell him, because my dad met my mom here in Phoenix because he was a Sunday school teacher at the local synagogue. I was afraid that he was going to be upset. I was really close with him. But he was very, very supportive. In fact, he gave me a Bible that he had bought. You know, he was dating a woman who Christianity was part of her faith. They didn't ultimately work out for other reasons, but he bought a Bible to try and get closer to her. So he gave me that Bible and another book about the Bible story. So he and I are still very close and he's very supportive, but I lost the entire, literally the entire rest of my family. In fact, they tried to run an intervention. After Thanksgiving of 2021, a couple family members invited me over to their house and it was kind of odd and I wasn't sure why, but I just kind of went in like praying that there wasn't an agenda. And it turns out that there was an agenda and they sprung it on me about an hour, hour and a half into it, like confronting me about becoming Christian and interrogating me about abortion, getting very upset. I got called batshit crazy. And
Oh my goodness, that's crazy.
Wow. Essentially, my family members don't talk. In fact, I wasn't even invited to Thanksgiving this year. So, I've lost my family over it.
Ah, that sucks. I'm sorry to hear that, but good for you. I mean, that's the cost of following Christ, but that's rough to go through for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I gave them my. That's the thing that hurts about it. It's like I can understand them reacting. Like, fine. Like, and I understand that the gospel does that. And I understand growing up Jewish that the one thing you are absolutely not allowed to do is become Christian. Like, you can become Muslim. Like, it won't really make sense, but like, you can do it. But if you become Christian, you have truly betrayed something, but no one will really articulate what. But it's like, I gave them my full testimony. And it's like, I told them exactly what happened. It was, I told it in a very beautiful way, in a very open way. And they didn't hear a word of it. Like, I would have thought, like, if it was legitimately out of concern for me, that they would be like, okay, well, you know, it's okay. We get it. Like, it's not what we're into, but it makes sense. It makes sense. So thank you. Instead, it was like hard rejection. And, you know,
that's a weird thing. Cause I've interacted with a lot of Jewish people on Twitter and they will be atheist Jewish people. They'll be pro-gay Jewish people, pro-abortion Jewish people that don't follow the kosher laws, and they're fine with all of that. But if someone says, well, convert to Christianity, like that's the one thing that excludes you from the group, which is crazy. It's crazy that there's that one line of demarcation that you just can't cross.
Yeah. I mean, well, I discovered Paul talks about that in Romans. Like Romans 9, 10, 11, he talks about the Jews. And if I don't have, you know, chapter and verse in front of me, but I'm pretty sure that that he identifies that that's actually a thing that's been done to Jews to punish them. I'm pretty sure like that they especially reject Christ because as punishment. Now, like I'm not a pastor, and so don't go saying that Will said, but I remember reading those.
Oh, you're not the only one who's has said that. And well, and actually I just finished a book called The Puritan Hope. It's more about why American Puritans and English Puritans had a post-millennial eschatology, which I know you're at Apologia Church, so I'm sure they talk about this quite a bit. But one of the things, what's really cool is that you're at the forefront of this. One of the things that they really believed was that Romans 11, they really believed that Romans 11 meant that the Jews will be saved. They will come to call Jesus their Messiah one day. And that prompted them, like a lot of their evangelism around the world, because, you know, Paul is saying all these things about how the world is going to be saved. And they take Paul very literally in Romans 11 to say that this will have the Jewish community will turn to Christ someday.
Yeah, I believe that too. I think, I read the Old Testament and I mean, like, I don't know. Do you want to keep your Twitter accounts? Because I can.
Well, so we promote Christian nationalism on our podcast. So
let's
waiting for the axe to fall eventually. Well, so go ahead.
Well, I mean, like how Kanye do you want to get with this? You know,
let's go.
Yeah.
Let's just say that I generously interpret the Old Testament as an ongoing record of consistent, persistent Jewish failure, you know, total failure to keep covenant over and over and over again. And I joke sometimes that one of the reasons for Christ is that God realized if you want something done right, you've got to do it yourself. And so, And that's kind of how I see that. And what I love reading about Paul is that, you know, the guy absolutely knows his stuff, and his eyes were opened and his heart turned to the Lord. And he puts forth some of the most fiery and inspiring, as you know, impassioned defenses. And he sees the sinfulness and rejection of God within his own heart and humbles his own pride before the Lord. And I think that that's probably one of the signature features of Jews going back into the Old Testament and up until today is pride before the Lord. And that doesn't go well for you. Now, that doesn't mean that the Lord won't ultimately win, because he will, but that pride that you identify, Lewis, is a real thing. And the thing that's odd about it is that it's not really tied to anything. So like, there'll be Jews who are atheists, like they literally do not believe in God. It's like, well, you know, where do you get your Jewish identity from? Like, oh, well, you know, because we're Jews. Well, what does that mean? Do Jews follow the Old Testament? Well, we don't believe in any of that. So where does your identity come from? Right.
Yeah,
and it's look, I was part of this. I know about all this. And so I'm open to engage with any Jews about it, you know?
Can I ask you a really non-politically correct, nothing we've said is politically correct, but let me ask you a question on that.
I think this is all totally within bounds.
But I could understand, I think all of us are kind of built in with racism and have an element of ethnic pride. And if I could understand being Jewish and seeing how successful so many Jewish people have been in almost every category of American life, right? You look at comedy, you look at Hollywood, you look at banking, you look at everything, right? Successful.
Except sports. And that'll be relevant to my answer. No, that's really relevant to my answer. Okay. No, go ahead. It's important.
But I could see, like, seeing all that. There's also that religious element of the chosen people, and kind of having the religion justify that natural tendency to say we're the best and everybody else is not the best. Like, so do you think there's an element, and I will say that's Martin Luther's critique of Judaism. He gets a really bad reputation for that, but that's his, if you read his critique, that's his primary critique. It's that nobody should take pride in their ethnicity as though that gives them a special place before God. And do you think there's that element of that within just your experience within the Jewish community?
I think so, but my experience growing up Jewish was more like the culture within my Jewish family was success at all costs, meaning that me as a young boy, will succeed professionally, first academically, right? You will do well in school, straight A's, all that, 4.0 plus GPA, and get into a great school and achieve highly in a career at all costs, meaning everything else is secondary to that. And the reason why I bring up sports is that particularly with Jewish boys, what that means is you will do nothing to damage this precious little veal, this little precious little lamb, because you must be cultivated towards professional success, and you can't be getting dirty, playing outside, playing team sports, or getting hurt, because none of that matters, because you have to succeed professionally. That makes a lot of sense. That's part of the culture. That's why you don't see Jews in sports. That's why you don't see. So in the movie Inglourious Basterds, have you guys seen this movie?
Yes.
Okay. So go ahead.
I was just going to say I have not, but go ahead.
All right, Lewis.
It's a great movie. Something to do. So there's this character in Inglourious Basterds called the Bear Jew. It's this very imposing, you know, big, strong figure who comes out during a pretty cool scene that Quentin Tarantino wrote. I don't want to spoil it, but the reason why the Bear Jew is funny is because, like, Jewish men don't look like that. You know, the other Jews in the unit look like we associate Jewish men with being like Woody Allen, right, or Jerry Seinfeld, right? The Bear Jew comes out, it's like Jews don't look like that, and there's a reason for that, because none of those values are important. None of these earthy values are important. It's all about a life of the mind, and unfortunately, that leads to very unbalanced, like, men just in general. When you take any man from anywhere and you cultivate him in the direction of professional, you know, mental achievement, right? It comes at the expense of his physical development and often his emotional development. That's just what happens, right? And so when I started developing myself as a man, I started to realize this was taking me away from the direction that I had been raised. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. But, you know, what you get in exchange for all this high achievement, this culturally ingrained high achievement, is you get a real lack of earthy values. And I think that the lack of earthy values, no matter where they show up, are a big problem. And if you achieve so highly, and if you have a network of people who do achieve highly, that's where a lot of that pride comes from. Now, the notion of being God's chosen people, I think, is radically misunderstood. Because I always looked, and this was literally just me. Like I was the chair of the social chair of the Jewish Students Association when I was in college. I always took, so it was like, it was part of my life. So I always took being, quote, God's chosen people as a position of servitude. Like it didn't make me special, right?
Okay.
It meant that I had an even greater burden to serve humanity. In fact, I have the words tikkun olam tattooed on my left shoulder. And there's a whole story around that tattoo, which means to heal the world. And so I truly believed, and still do, that the responsibility of Jews is to bring the world closer together, is to serve the world. And because I think I think Christ was the greatest example of that. The alternative seems to be something to rule the world, I guess, in some sense, or certainly, you know, certainly to be held up as like, look how great we are. It's like, no, I don't think that's what being God's chosen people was about.
Right. Which, especially if you read N.T. Wright, where he talks about, I don't know how much of N.T. Wright you've read, but like he talks about the fact that was Jesus, one of Jesus's main critiques with the Pharisees and with the people of the first century was that they weren't living out that calling to be. And he goes back to Exodus chapter 20, I believe, or 19, maybe, where it says you are a nation of priests, and that they weren't being this nation of priests. They weren't being these people that connected all the other nations with the God of Israel, that they were failing to do that. And that was one of Jesus's central critiques of Pharisaic, or however you say it. But that's an interesting observation on your side. Good.
It's a very valid critique. Like they let it go to their heads, you know, like that's not what you're supposed to do, right? Yeah. And I think the ultimate shaming power, though he didn't, with Christ, is just his embodiment of like, no, this is kind of what y'all were supposed to do the whole time. Here, I'm just going to show you. Like and that was what I remember when I was first reading the New Testament. I was because I had grown up with this image, Jesus, meek and mild. You know, that was just what I had absorbed culturally from my limited exposure. And when I was reading the New Testament and saw Jesus getting angry and just dunking ugly all over the Pharisees all the time, you know, and looking at his yeah. you know, Peter and all of his disciples, and just being like, you guys are knuckleheads. Like seeing his response to the environment around him, I was like, this is a human being, right? And it was particularly his relationship to the Pharisees that was like the way that he would thread the needle, like on these, they'd slice fine the law, you know. It's like, well, what about that? And that Jesus would just throw the thread through the eye of the needle from across the room. Like, it's like that, idiots, come on.
Yeah. I love that. There is that funny passage from Matthew 15 where he has them over to dinner, or he goes to dinner with them. I don't know if it was his house or theirs, but he starts talking about kind of between the lines about how hypocritical they are. And at some point in time, his disciples pull him aside and they say, don't you know that they were offended by what you're saying? Yeah, so like, there's like they can see how offensive Jesus is being to them. So it goes against that picture of him walking around with a faraway look in his eyes and light behind his head, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So all these things are
awesome.
It's cool to get to talk about all these things. I did not see this coming, but I love it.
We kind of end up going, sometimes we go in very different directions, but that's the Lewis and Lucas podcast for you, everybody. Put
awesome.
A shameless plug in there. So we try to keep it to an hour. I don't think we've ever done that, but that's what we try to do. I wanted to ask you as we wrap up, what your go-to biblical, like your examples of Christian masculinity that you point the people that you're coaching, where in the Bible you point them to. And then if you have time, Will, I was gonna, if people want to request a mic, if they want to ask you something, I'll let them do that if you're available.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, awesome. So if you are interested in asking Will a question, request a mic from me. And yeah, Will, what your go-to resources for in the Bible as you're pointing your people you're coaching towards Christian masculinity?
I think it depends on what aspect of masculinity needs to be highlighted, because I think the masculinity, and this is one of the things that I love about the Bible, and Christianity, is that there are so many different men scattered all throughout the Bible that embody so many different qualities. I could point someone to Paul, right? And the depth of his thought and the clarity of his writing and the depth of his compassion and submission and the tenderness, right? I could point people to Paul for that. Or if you want to see brazen, brash, bold, outspoken, righteous, godly masculinity, point him to David. You can point people to Joseph, right? Or to John the Baptist for being, wild and prophetic. And to put together this mosaic of what it means to be a man, or Solomon, right? Solomon ultimately obviously lost his way, but to read Proverbs and to read Ecclesiastes, like I remember I was reading Marcus Aurelius' Meditations and Proverbs at the same time. And so I would read Proverbs in the morning and then Meditations in the evening. And I was just like, when I realized, like, here are these men speaking to me across thousands of years of time, that these were real men writing down real thoughts that I now get to connect with and learn from. It was a very powerful experience to be connected to history. But to read Ecclesiastes, like, it's all vanity. Like, look, Andrew Tate, I've done all the things. It's totally empty. Like, if we could transport Solomon forward, he'd have a bit to say about Andrew Tate, right? But so I guess it depends on what the man needs, because my mentor is this man named Glenn, and Glenn was once part of the Mankind Project, which I mentioned earlier, and he has personally initiated thousands of men. Like, Glenn knows more about men's hearts than any man that I've ever met or read. And he said to me, he said, Will, men are like trees. He said, all trees have the same features, but no two trees are alike. And so different men will come with different needs, especially in mentorship, for where they're looking to grow. And that's just true. And so what I love about Christianity, unlike any other religion that I've found, is that it can point to these virtuous examples of earthly masculinity, like ways that men are actually on the earth. So you look at Hinduism, for example, like, yeah, you can pull together a bunch of these different gods, but whether the gods are demons or not, they're mythological creatures, versus the Bible is telling real stories, of real men. Job, for example, right? And so I guess it depends on the man, but that there are so many examples, to me, really fills out the complete story of Christianity, because it's almost like Christ naturally is this, if you were to look at it like a painting on the wall, is this giant figure whose light drowns out the light of all these other men. But if you dial that back a little bit in your imagination and you see the mosaic of all the different men through the Bible, it's truly a powerful religion for men to encounter as men. And so I draw from that in my mentorship with my clients.
Amen. My favorite, and actually my oldest son, we named him Amos. He's my favorite masculine. It's been my, I guess, has been for several years. I love that his story. He did not grow up in a prophecy school. However, he was a farmer in the Southern Kingdom. This is when the Kingdom of Israel was split into two different entities, the Northern and the Southern Kingdom. So he's in the Southern Kingdom and is a farmer, and God calls him to prophesy in the Northern Kingdom. And he answers, and he starts off, he's prophesying against Egypt and some other neighboring countries, and then starts going in hard on Israel. And then the middle of the book of Amos, or toward, I think it's towards the end, where the high priest of the new religion that they, because they've left God, they've created their this new religion. This high priest confronts Amos and says, "All right, hey, you need to stop because, we're gonna make you regret it, basically. And Amos's response is, hey, I'm doing what God want me to do. So if you have a problem, you could take it up with him. And he had like, he's just so bold. He never wavers. And then after he's done, after his ministry is done, he goes back and becomes a farmer again. I'm like, that is such a simple faith. Just, God calls him, he goes up and does his thing. And when God's like, all right, that's good job. He goes back to farming. It's like, goes back to being that simple family man who has placed his faith in God. It's been one of my favorite Old Testament books for a long time.
Yeah, that's one of the classic aspects of masculinity, because you look at, you see that in popular culture in the movie Gladiator. Like, all Maximus wants to do is get back to his wheat fields and his wife and kids. And it even shows up in the Avengers movies, because Thanos, when Thanos does the snap, what does he do? He just goes back to a small hut on like a farm, kind of, right? Like, there's something within, Thanos is obviously an evil character, but there's something, but he's a complete man in his own way. There's something within men, the completed men, where it's like, ultimately our needs are very simple. We can serve God in these very, very powerful ways, but when the mission is done, we can lead very simple, contented lives with ourselves. And I think that's one of the least understood, aspects of masculinity, especially today, when, you drive the flashy car, or you get the big house, and there are a lot of guys who are like, you know what? Like, I'm happy with a cabin in the woods. I have very simple needs to provide for those I love, and once I've done what I need to do, like, I'm content with that. And so that's a beautiful story.
Yeah, I can't remember what comedian it was. It was like Chappelle, maybe. I can't remember, but he basically said, if you're driving a car, a fast car, living in a big house, that's probably for the woman, either the future woman or your current woman. It's not for you. That most men can just live in a 10 by 10 room. Like, we don't need a lot as men.
I mean, there's an extent to which, a man who achieves in generating prosperity likes to create things for himself that demonstrate his achievement. Like, there is some component to that. But when it becomes showy, I think we started out talking about that the classic Greeks and the Romans regarded flashy displays of wealth as feminine. And I do agree with that. And it is possible, to like, well, I made $1 billion, and I would like to have a nice house on the lake because that's what I want. But yeah, in general, men can lead pretty simple lives, and be quite content with that.
Do you remember that meme like somebody posted? It was a guy, it was like a living room. It didn't have any furniture. It had like a chair, and the
Yes.
TV was on the floor. And the woman posted was like, men are actually happy with this.
Yes. And it had these big windows looking out over a city. It's like a TV on the floor, a bed on the floor, and these big windows looking out over the city. Like, men can live this way. It's like, well, yeah.
Yeah. Oh man. This has been, we may have to have you back on again because I have so many other questions, especially like as you navigate the Twitterverse promoting your ideas. Like, we didn't get into that as much. As a reformed Christian myself, I have a lot of enmity between the Theo Bros. That's all they do is critique, and but I think what's the most fascinating aspect of your story, Will, is when you stood your ground with your family. Like, I have not had to pay such a high cost for my faith, and the fact that you stood that, endured that, and suffered that for your faith, I think is a huge testament to what you're trying to do, the masculinity that you're promoting, and your faith in Christ.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. That was a very difficult moment that caused me a lot of pain, and continues to in many ways. And at the same time, the truth is the truth. And Lewis will appreciate this. Like, I've done 15 ayahuasca ceremonies, which is a lot, and I've been to that Hindu festival. Like, I've bathed in the Ganges River at this Hindu festival, 190 million Hindus, and you know, I've done a 10-day meditation retreat in the mountains of Kashmir, like 10 hours of meditation a day for 10 days. Like, I've done the thing. I've been to all the New Age retreats. Like, I've done the thing. I've looked in with my own mind, my own heart, and my own body, and I found them all wanting. And I come back from this, and I tell this story to people. It's like, no, this is the truth. And I can lay out for you exactly why. And so that my family wasn't able or willing to hear it for whatever reasons doesn't change the nature of the truth. And so, you know, there's a component of the truth, like the waves, the ocean breaks around the rock. You know, the rock doesn't break around the waves. And so that's just how it is. And I hope, and I pray for them. I pray that for them that they'll come to see the truth. And I pray that the world will come to see the truth. And future conversations, let's talk about postmillennialism, because I love it. I think that it's an eschatology that drives us forward into the world to act and to serve. And I think that's such an incredibly powerful posture that informs a lot of what I do. But thank you.
Amen.
So the takeaway here is just do a lot of ayahuasca. Is that?
No.
That's another thing we have to have, like, cause yeah. Like, you know, as you're aware, and I'm sure people who follow the show are aware, Lewis wrote that incredible, which if you have not picked it up yet, pick it up. It's a great, you know, and I'm still not seeing other Christians pick this up, but we're trying this idea that we really need to be cautious. We taking a libertarian approach to drugs and drug legalization. That's really, really, really bad. And we didn't talk to you because you had mentioned like the Jungian sort of ideology in the Bay Area. So I'm sure you have a lot of really good thoughts on, like, because Peterson himself is a giant fan of Jung, and you know, I'm sure in talking about masculinity, you've run into Peterson in your work too. We'll have to talk about that. Like, there's a lot of stuff we'll have to do this again for sure.
Anytime. It's been a joy talking to you guys.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks. Thanks, Will. And repeat your website. Your website is, where can people find more about you?
You can find me at, my website is renofmen.com, but the easiest way to find me across all the different social media platforms and my podcast is linktree.com/renofmen. And if you're interested in my 12-week Renaissance Men's mentorship that I'm very, very, very proud of, you can go to renofmen.com/mentorship and see testimonials and find out more about that program.
Awesome. And when we post this episode, we'll put that in the description and link to your Twitter as well. The book that Lucas mentioned that I wrote on ayahuasca is called The Return of the Dragon. It's available on Amazon. I hope everybody checks that out. You can follow me at I am Lewis U, Lewis with a E, on Twitter. And you can also check me out on Substack, Lewis Ungit, UNGIT.substack.com. Lucas, you can follow at Addicted to Grace, the number 2, on Twitter. Has lots of good things to say on Twitter, so I hope you check him out. Lucas, you got anything else?
I think that's everything. Thank you to Will. Thanks everybody for coming. People who follow the show know that I do a master thread. I'm in Vegas on vacation with my wife this weekend, so I will not be doing the master thread today. But I do, you know, like if you heard Will like reference, you know, the Bronze Age Perfect or Ram Dass, whatever, what I do is I re-listen to the show and pick out all those things and have this master thread on Twitter. So you can go through, and if you're interested in checking out these different resources, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, all these different things we talked about, I tried to do that thread. So follow and you will seek and ye shall find.
Absolutely. Excellent. All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Right. Bye-bye.